I'm going to do something a little, we'll do something maybe just a little bit different here. We're going to turn the lights down just a little bit. You may have heard a little something about Thanksgiving coming up. Do you mind if I take us way back in the way back machine? Boys and girls, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. I've got a significant history geek quotient going on. So do you mind if we just take a quick little memory? Here we go. Let's go with our first slide here. Here is that beautiful, beautiful painting by Jean Leon Ferris. He painted it in 1912. It hangs in the Library of Congress. There it is. There's your first Thanksgiving. Now, you probably know and have heard that, there's folks that want to bring a great, different story and slant. What I'm going to share with you tonight comes from William Bradford. He was on the Mayflower, and he was one of the first leading sort of elders of the whole place. 102 pilgrims came over on the Mayflower. If you didn't know, there was actually two ships that kind of got started. There was the Speedwell, as well as the Mayflower, and there were a whole lot more to the group or the contingency. And some suspect that the crew of the Speedwell was probably not wholeheartedly involved with the endeavor. There were some financial interesting things going on, but how many of you guys know that when you step out for the Lord, the enemy is not far from behind? So they set out. They were supposed to leave on August the 5th, and then they got just a little ways out of the Isles, the British Isles, and then the Speedwell began to come apart at her seams. They pulled back into Southampton, and they fixed her up one more time, and out they went the second time. And again, she was putting on too much sail or whatever it was, but the masts were working loose, and it looked like, can't take the Speedwell. So they go back to England, back to Southampton, and they combine all of that luggage from two full ships, and they cut down the first wave of folks that are going, and then they finally get started. Well, where were they heading to? There's planet Earth. If you haven't seen it in a while, there it is. I hit her first go button. There's Virginia. They were supposed to land in Virginia. That was what their charter was for. Virginia, as you know, 10 years in front, the first permanent English settlement was there, but it wasn't going well at all. The pilgrims were not interested in an enterprise in and of itself. For over 11 years, they were trying to get out from under the heavy hand of the Church of England. What's the Church of England? Well, Henry VIII, I am. He had the hots for someone not his wife, so he divorced his wife and tried to get an annulment from the then Spanish Pope. And the Spanish Pope says, I don't think so. So what is King Henry VIII, undeterred? He says, fine, I'll start my own religion. And he does, the Church of England. And by the time the scene opens up in the early 1600s, it was a church that was the predominant sort of religion and expression of Great Britain at the time. And in fact, if you were caught reading a Bible that was, heaven forbid, as we should say, an English translation from the Latin, you could get in big trouble for that. And there were people that were following other believers around, and if you were caught in what we would describe as a home fellowship, you could be arrested, and worse, you could have your stuff seized, you could be thrown in jail. So they said, we can't really change the hierarchy of the Church of England. So they said, well, maybe we'll try it somewhere else. And so they all picked up and they moved to Leiden in Holland. And that wasn't working out either. The only thing they were going to really do, the only place they could really go, was the New World. But you need to know something. What was coming back? What was the news coming back from the Jamestown settlement? Awful news. Because their whole plan was different, they were sort of there to make an industry. And so you had that hierarchy of the haves ruling over the have-nots and the gentry system and all that. So the leaders wouldn't get out of their tents, and consequently many of them died from some of the interesting diseases. Plus also Native Americans were there as well, who took a dim view on getting shot at. And so there was a very contentious there at Jamestown in Virginia. So here is what the news was coming back. 9 out of every 10 settlers were dying there. Can you imagine? Well, we're going to start a church. Where are you going to start a church at? The next county? No. How about across the ocean? I've heard about that place. Isn't there a whole lot of folks dying? It was a tremendous series and steps of faith. It's a wonderful read if you ever want to look at it. William Bradford wrote on or of Plymouth Plantation. You can read his firsthand accounts. And then Mewart's Relations, and there was another, there were other articles that you could get to. And how they arrived at hearing God to say go was an interesting process. Well, there's Virginia. That's where they were supposed to go, hit the go button. But they ended up, because they left so late, and they wanted to go across the North Atlantic because they figured there would be less of a chance of pirates. And they were a month behind. They actually didn't set out until September the 6th. So that's where they got. That's where they ended up because of the tremendous storms. And if you do the math on it, they were on board the ship for 66 days. 100 feet long and about 25 feet wide with 102 other humans, not counting the crew. Well, that's where they ended up. Let's zoom in. Go ahead. There's Massachusetts Bay. And see that little boot kind of hanging out there? That's Provincetown. That's Massachusetts Bay. Hit the go button. We zoom in a little bit more. Hit the go button again. There's Massachusetts right there. Hit our go button. There's Massachusetts Bay. When they first hear land ho, if you do the math, they average less than 4 miles per hour. And because they were not a powered ship, when the waves were rolling at them, they could barely keep steerage, and more often than not, you want to push your nose into the wave, but they were often bowed over and then rolling in the troughs of these waves. The winds were so contrary and so strong that they had to roll up their sails. It's called hulling. So they were able to rope them up, and they just basically bobbed up and down for 66 days. When they finally hear land ho, they rush to the rails and they see not Virginia. They see, it takes them a minute to figure out where they are because they had rudimentary maps. We're not in Virginia. This is Provincetown. We're in Massachusetts. Uh-oh. So what they do is they turn south. And you see the two big islands at the bottom of Massachusetts? That's Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, those two islands. And you see the bottom sort of little land at the bottom of the boot? It sticks out. Those are treacherous shoals. There are uncertain currents that are coming out of the riverbeds there. And sailors today know you stay well clear of those. And Bradford tells about the voyage that they spotted those shoals too late, and then they pray to the Lord, you've got to get us out of here. We're going to get run aground on those shoals and then get beat to death, and our whole Mayflower is going to come apart. And then Bradford relates a story. Suddenly, the wind shifted 180 degrees in the other direction. They got out of the shoals, and then they went back up to Provincetown, and they said, well, what are we going to do? Do we sail south where our charter is, or do we put in here at Massachusetts where there was no charter? Here's the problem. If they were to land in Virginia, then, of course, the charter says, here's how y'all will behave yourself. If they set foot here in Massachusetts Bay, there are no charters. It could be every man for themselves. So Captain Cook is asked by Bradford and Carver, who was the pastor of that group, don't put in yet. Can you imagine 66 days, a couple more days, almost getting wrecked on the shoals? And now you're coming up on 70-plus days in that ship. Let's get out of here. But They said we have to find and we have to agree on some form of government, because if we land there, we're outside of our charter. And they wrote a little document called the Mayflower Compact. Why is that so important? Because it was radical. It basically said something like this: if you work for this community, you have a say in voting its leadership. Radical. In South there in Virginia, that's not how it was. The guys with the fancy mustaches and the fancy clothes, they told everybody what to do, and those that were underneath them had nothing to say about it. The Mayflower Compact is so important because it was the seedbed for this bizarre notion of one man, one vote. Well, they pull in across the top, and they pull in at Provincetown. And then at Provincetown, they send a shallop across. And then they find this beautiful place. Go ahead. Plymouth Bay. Beautiful. Plymouth Bay. And then they struck in land a little bit, and they found this. Go ahead. You see Provincetown at the top? They camped. They put their anchor there. Then they sent the shallop across. And then there's Plymouth. See the left? Hit our go button. Plymouth is right there. That's where Plymouth Colony is going to be built. But when they pressed inside a little bit more, they found something very bizarre. They found this. Go ahead. They found Gillette Stadium where the Patriots play. Foxborough. No, they didn't. I'm sorry. I'm messing with you. But there's an idea. There's your Massachusetts Bay. There's Cape Cod, as you see, and then Plymouth. Go ahead. Here's a shot of something called Mayflower 2. In the early 1950s, based on some newly discovered sort of documentation, they had a pretty good idea of what the Mayflower might have looked like. And so they raised private funds, and then a bunch of guys made this. It's out of wood, according to the same fashion as the Mayflower itself. This is called Mayflower 2. It was completed, I want to say, around 1955. It's been refitted a couple times, but it's built to the exact specifications. Notice it's not a very big ship. Go ahead. Here it is in Plymouth Bay, and there's the tourist, and then there's a shot of roughly how big that ship is. Hit the go button. You'll see the gentleman standing there at the rail. Right under his feet is something called the tween decks. Because of the terrible and temperate weather, every one of the pilgrims was sealed under the deck there in the tween decks. It's not very large. You want to get a shot of it? Here's what it looks like. Wow, it's a little bigger than I thought. No, that's not the tween decks. Go ahead. I'm messing with you. There's a shot of the tween decks. If you were over 6 feet tall, you had to duck. It's roughly the size of a volleyball court. 102 people plus all of their the stuff that they were going to use to plant their food. When they first get started, remember, these pilgrims are not really sea type people, and so within a few days they begin to experience something called the sours. Because they couldn't cook outside, they basically had to break in to their store of seeds. So they had to eat a lot of seeds and seed byproducts. Read that: high fiber. And because of their seasickness, they couldn't keep hardly anything down, so it was coming out of both ends, and it was absolutely miserable. By the way, where would you go if you had such a terrible tummy ache and a severe indisposition of your intestines? You had to go between two curtains and a pot. How many of you would never sign up for a voyage like that? Go ahead. Here's a shot of it. Hit the go button again. We'll zoom in. And one more time, go button. There's your tween decks right there. You'll notice the casks that are underneath there. There's an interesting story that the Billingsley boys were not pilgrims. They were called merchant explorers. And they were in their mid-teens. Do I have his name here? The Billington boys. They were bored, so they went underneath the tween decks, and they found the casks of gunpowder as well. And they found the boxes where the quills were. What's the quill? On your musket, you had a reservoir of gunpowder, as you know, that you packed down behind the bullet. And then you had a mechanism that you lit on fire, and it would smolder. Those were called quills. You pull the trigger, and the smoking quill would dip into the reservoir of gunpowder, fire it off, and your bullet would fire out the end. So the quills were very flame. You could light them on fire easily. And when they couldn't find the Billingsley boys, where did you guys go? They found them underneath the tween decks, and they were lighting quills on fire and throwing them at each other over the casks of gunpowder. Yeah. They scolded them appropriately, and then something else happened. That main mast, see where the main mast is right down in the middle? You'll see at the very top there's a beam that goes across and supports it on one side. The main beam cracked and sagged dangerously. And if that middle or main beam were to fail, then as you know, the mast, the center mast, would not be sufficiently supported, and that could mean real disaster. The challenge was that they were halfway across. What do we do? Do we go back or do we go forward? And somebody remembered, I have an idea. Go ahead with your next picture. This is a picture of a big metal screw that is a part of a printing press. Edward Winslow, he had a printing press with him. So they broke out the printing press big iron screw, and then you'll see the cross section. They put under the cargo hold, they put big beams, and then they put the jack screw on top of that. And then the guys wrestled the big screw and cranked that main beam back into place. And therefore, well, let's just keep going. By the way, that beam is thought to actually have been found. The Mayflower, a few years after its work with the Pilgrims, it was retired. And as you know, beams of that size were quite valuable. And it was a detail of where these beams landed. And they think that they found the barn that it went into and built. I had a picture of it, then I couldn't. I lost it. I forget where it is. But there's a picture of it, and it's a main beam across a barn, and it still has a repaired crack in it. I don't know. Next picture. This is an interesting story. This is John Howland. And as you know, there's a good picture. You see the sails are wrapped up. That's called hulling. And so you don't want to rip up your sails, so you bind them up, and then you just wade out and roll across those big swells, really in the troughs. John Howland at the time was 28 years of age, and he had had enough of this being between the tween decks, the stench and the smell. I got to get some air. So he dodged Captain Jones's direct mandate, and he went up on top of the deck. He was immediately washed over the side by a big swell. The North Atlantic, now we are in the early days of December. And as you know, you're not going to last very long. He was to say later, as he was in the water, that he cried out to the Lord. He was not known to be a pious young man at 28. He was more of an adventurer. But when he is floating in the sea, and of course they wouldn't turn around and come get you, he cried out to the Lord, "Please, God, save me." And as the sails were hauled or rolled up, their trailing lines would then drag into the water. And as he cried out to the Lord, he felt the rope go across his wrist, and he instinctively closed his wrist, and he held on to that rope, and then he yelled, "Help, help, help," and they were able to pull him aboard. Good thing, because he would marry this lady. Go ahead. This is Elizabeth Tilley. She was a pilgrim, and in the first winter, 44 of the 102 died, including her mom and her dad and her siblings. She was 13 years of age at the crossing, and 4 years later, she married John Howling. And by that time, he's 32, and they had 11 children. John Howling lived to be over 80 years of age. And it's a good thing, too, because there's all kinds of presidents and leaders and congressmen and Humphrey Bogart who are directly descended from John Howland and Elizabeth Tilley. Keep going. Go ahead. Well, they land, as you know, they take the shallop across, and then they land there at Plymouth Rock. Go ahead. And then they begin to build, because by the time they actually landed, they don't start building until December the 21st. What is New England weather like near Gillette Stadium, where the Patriots play, usually around December this time? Bitter, bitter cold. And they worked because many of them were still sort of staying on the Mayflower, and the only way you could get in was to jump out of the shallop, and then you'd get wet really to the knees and sometimes the hips. So they barely got the very first building done. It was the Common House, and then people began to succumb to significant illness. Hit our go button. This is a replica. This is called Plymouth Plantation. It's a living museum. You go there today, and you will encounter people in period dress. Go ahead. And when you encounter them, they will be very polite to you. But if you mention anything about the internet or newspapers, they'll say, what? Because they're totally in character. They're acting like they're 1620 people. There's what one of your houses looked like. They had wood siding. And in England, that would be, of course, very expensive. But here's what the inside looked like. Go ahead. Imagine for the next several years of your life, there's one side of your house with a fireplace. And there's Ma. Hey, Ma. Now turn around, go ahead, and there's the other side. And there's where your family lived. This is what they endured. Go ahead. This is a replica. It's not the same house, but it's a replica of the palisade. It was the common room. And by the mid-portion of that first winter, people had been so sick, there were only 2 to 3 of the young teenage girls who were strong enough to walk outside. Fearing the Indians, Priscilla Mullins and Desire Minter, who were 17-year-old girls, would put on men's hat and clothes and muskets, and they would walk across the top of the wall there, or the palisades. And then they would go inside, change hat and clothes, and then walk around some more. Because if anybody was watching, they would think that there were several men healthy, and there was hardly a one. Go ahead. Here are your actors. They will interact with you, but they will know nothing of modern appliances. It's a beautiful place. You can see the common house in the back. Go ahead. And, of course, the Wampanoags, those were the group of people that were sort of close. Those are your Native Americans, and they lived in a house that looked a little bit like this. Go ahead. You know the story. They didn't know that they were going to make it. Finally, half of their numbers had perished. They were eating into the seeds that they were going to try to plant for the next season. And they were seriously wondering if they shouldn't all get on the Mayflower and head back to England, because they were miserable. Then the story happens that in mid-March, they hear somebody from the Palisades yell, Indian, you know. Well, shouldn't it be Indians? Because remember, they had heard all the terrible stories of what had been happening in Virginia. So they raced out and they opened up the doors, and standing there in the common room, or near the common room, was a tall, handsome Algonquin Native American. And he says to them in perfect English, hello and welcome. Do you have any beer? True story, they're all, what? They tell him what's been going on, and he, Samoset, says, I think I have someone who might be able to help you. The next time he returns, this, of course, is perhaps what he looked like, perhaps what he didn't, we don't know, but a young Native American by the name of Squanto, Tisquantum. What a story. 10 years in front of this, he had been captured by some awful people, taken back and sold as a slave. He had made his way and earned his passage, and he was on his way back to his home area there in Plymouth. He was captured again, carted back across the Atlantic, and then he is purchased by a friar who teaches him English and leads him to the saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. At least that's how the claim goes. He finally made his way back, and when he arrives at his native grounds there where the pilgrims are, all of his people, the Patuxets, they're all dead. They're all gone. Probably measles, who knows, but there was nobody left. Had the pilgrims have tried to settle a little north or to the little to the south, they would have encountered fierce opposition. It's tragic that those Native Americans were killed, probably by some European disease, yet it was the only place on the eastern seaboard where the Pilgrims could have landed without terrible opposition. So it was Tisquantum who shows them how to live in the area, how to know when different runs of species of fish were coming into the creeks. He showed them the classic on how to plant corn. We tried that. We can't really get anything going. Here's how you do it. You scrape back some topsoil, you put your kernels of corn, and then you get some fish, and you put them nose to nose, forming the spokes of a wheel, and then you bury it. But you got to keep an eye on it, because the decomposing fish will attract wolves. And then, of course, all the others. But here's what Squanto really showed them. How to trap, how to skin, and prepare beaver pelts. It was the beaver pelt industry that really allowed the plantation, Plymouth Plantation, to get an economic foothold. And that is the beginning, really, of the people. Because in about 10 more years, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, more Puritans, a little different from the Pilgrims, but they settle on the top of the Massachusetts Bay and found Boston. And if you're a political science buff like I am, we can trace practically all of our founding fathers from this sort of understanding of these people who wanted to read, study, and understand their Bibles. Were there knuckleheads? Yes. But by and large, the ethos, what really started our America, were folks that came from the Mayflower and from the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Go ahead. Back to that first year. Here's that beautiful painting. This is Jean Augusta Brownscombe's 1914 depiction of the very first Thanksgiving there. And as you know, William Bradford, they made friends with the Wampanoags and King Massasoit. And so they said, we're going to make it, we think, thanks to the godsend of Squanto. So he invites them over to celebrate God's good giving. And so that's what they did. And they were a little sort of nervous when Massasoit shows up with 90 other Native Americans. But he didn't come in empty-handed. They had killed and dressed out 5 full deer. And it was a day of games and fun, but more or less what they were really thankful for was, Lord, by your grace, we will begin. And that was your first Thanksgiving. Go ahead to our next slide. This is from the Second Continental Congress. This is November the 1st, 1777. Why is that date important? Because just about 20 days in front of this Second Continental Congress's proclamation was that fateful battle of Saratoga. If you know your history on that, it was the Battle of Saratoga that was the turning point of the Revolutionary War. And who was it? The British Admiral, he surrenders, and everybody knows it was a complete God thing on how that all happened. And so taken by God's good graces, that the Second Continental Congress, the one that had approved the Declaration of Independence a few years in front, they wrote this. We're going to dim the lights, and then I'm going to read this to you, and then, Lord willing, I hope to read some psalms. We're not going to study anything else more tonight. I hope you don't mind. We're just going to thank God in worship and praise. You guys okay with that? Yes. That's the right answer, by the way. Well done, well done. The Second Continental Congress. It is therefore recommended to the legislative or executive powers of these United States to set apart Thursday, the 18th day of December next, for solemn thanksgiving and praise, that at one time and with one voice the good people may express the grateful feelings of their hearts and consecrate themselves to the service of their divine benefactor. It goes on, and that together with their sincere acknowledgments and offerings, they may join the penitent confession. What's another way of saying penitent confession? Repentance. You don't hear that coming out of Washington these days, do we? That they may join the penitent confession of their manifold sins, whereby they had forfeited every favor, and their humble and earnest supplication that it may please God through the merits of, say it with me because it's in the National Congressional Record, Jesus Christ. Separation of church and state. Do your homework. Merciful to forgive and blot them out of remembrance, that it may please Him graciously to afford His blessing on the governments of these states respectively. Lord, America has been greatly blessed. There is no doubt about that. And Lord, too often we are patting ourselves on the back, Lord, for our own ingenuity. Look how smart we are. And we have forgotten, by and large, the men and women who trusted you to such an extent that they lifted up families and roots from an entire other nation, braved 66 days of tossing seas. And after half of their number had perished, they believed you, Lord, and said, we're supposed to stay. And then more of their believing friends would come in the years to follow. And the very nation that we enjoy today, by and large, ideologically speaking, began in this particular fashion and manner. They thanked you often. So I'm going to read a couple of Thanksgiving Psalms. Psalm 50, verses 14 through 15. Present to God a thankful heart and repay your vows to the Most High. Pray to me when you are in trouble, and I will deliver you, and you will honor me. Psalm 67. Let the people thank God. Let all the people thank you. Let the people celebrate in joy, with joy, because you judge the nations fairly and you guide all the nations of the earth. Let the people thank you, God. Let all the people thank you. Psalm 92. It is fitting to thank the Lord, to sing praises to your name, O Most High. It is fitting to proclaim your loyal love in the morning and your faithfulness during the night, to the accompaniment of 10-string instruments and lyre, to the accompaniment of meditative tone of the harp. For you, O Lord, have made me happy by your work, and I will sing for joy because of what you have done. Oh, how great are your works, O Lord. Psalm 100. Know that the Lord is good. He made us. We belong to Him. We are His people, the sheep of His pasture. Enter into His gates with thanksgiving and enter His courts with praise. Thank Him, oh, bless His name, because the Lord is good. His love lasts forever. Psalm 111. I will give thanks to the Lord with my whole heart in the assembly of the godly and in the congregation. The Lord's deeds are great. His work is majestic and glorious, and His faithfulness endures forever. Psalm 95, verses 1 through 9. Oh, come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout out praises to our protector who delivers us. Let us enter into His presence with thanksgiving, and let us shout out to Him in celebration. For the Lord is great. He is a great God, a great King who is superior to all others. The depth of the earth are in His hand, and the mountain peaks belong to Him. The sea is His, for He made it. His hands formed the dry land. come. Let us bow down and worship. Let us kneel before the Lord, our Creator, for He is our God, and we are the people of His pastures, the sheep of His hands.